May it please the court, Mayor Vanderbilt, represent Mr. Jones. In terms of the attempted robbery, I'll address that first. There is insufficient evidence in this case to convict Mr. Jones of attempted robbery under the case law. Jordan v. Commonwealth, which is cited in the appellant's brief, is controlling in this case. In Jordan v. Commonwealth, we have very analogous facts to those at present. In Jordan v. Commonwealth, we have two co-defendants who are at the location that the robbery is supposed to take place. They're actually around the corner. They are, one of them is standing there with gun in hand, looking at the door of the store. The evidence showed that they had walked through it multiple times and actually made a purchase. They were casing the store, as the court noted. And when the police were watching them, they heard a siren. They yelled, one of them yelled an obscenity, and they ran. At that point, they're caught by the police. The court, first they were convicted, obviously. The Court of Appeals determined that that was insufficient evidence to convict them of attempted robbery. And the reason for that is because there was no actual act towards the completion, the commencement of the consummation of the offense.
The court in Jordan seems to kind of lay out the traditional view of overt act and intent, that some combination of overt acts will give rise to an intent, and seem to say that there's enough there to infer that they intended to rob the store, but because we had to infer the intent, there wasn't enough other things to go to overt act. Is that
my understanding from Your Honor is that they found there was more than sufficient evidence to determine that they were going to rob the store because of all the facts that they had, but simply that they had never stepped past simply conspiracy and planning.
In Therrington and Fortune, we note that when you have to prove the two elements, that if your evidence of intent is really strong, then your evidence, it's kind of a sliding scale, that the overt act can be only slight. In Jordan, it seems there was an inference of intent. We don't have an inference of intent here, do we? We have an out-and-out statement that he was intending to effectively assist in a robbery.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so given that we have a crystal clear, 100%, can't be challenged, his own words, demonstration of the intent to commit the crime, we don't need as much evidence of overt act as was necessary in Jordan. That's what our cases say, right?
So, Your Honor, in terms of the sliding scale, if we look at the evidence in Jordan, we can say, sure, there was an inference, but that inference was very weak. They were around the corner, gun in hand, mask on. They had cased the store multiple times. They had made a purchase. They ran when they heard a siren, and they tried to get on a bike. They ran from police. They didn't have to make a very large leap in logic to get from there to, they probably were planning on robbing the place that they had cased and were waiting at. And sure, in the present case, we do have an admission, and we stipulated in the appellant's brief that there was a conspiracy to commit robbery. That being said, there is still a substantial burden on the Commonwealth to show that the requisite act had been completed. There was a very, very slight inference in Jordan. There is no necessary inference here, but they still have to meet the burden to show that the necessary act actually took place. Jordan shows us kind of where that line is, and the facts in this case are even further removed from that line. In Jordan, we had the benefit of knowing where the location of the place that was to be robbed, knowing where the defendants were. Everything was in place. In the present case, the record is completely devoid of where the victim even lived. We know that there was an intent to rob the victim. We know that the victim was likely somewhere in that area, but exactly where was never established at trial. They didn't even establish at trial that they were prepared to go.
If the Commonwealth had introduced evidence that that was where his apartment was, or that was where he, I believe, engaged in his profession, which I believe was a drug dealer.
Yes, ma'am.
If that evidence had been introduced, that they believed him to be there, would that have been enough?
I would say still no, Your Honor. They would be closer, but no, for a couple of reasons. First of all, in Jordan, if that corner in the present case, if that corner had been the corner where the drug dealer was performing his trade, or if that had been his house, that would put us in an analogous position to that of Jordan, where they were at the corner. Also, in the present case, we know that the robber was actually masterminded by someone called Tripp. That's the name that he went by. The co-defendants were there to assist Tripp. Tripp was not located anywhere on the scene when the robbery actually took place. To say we know that they had not only completed the planning for the robbery, but they had actually commenced it, which is the Attorney General's burden. To say that, I think puts a burden on them to say, well, then where was the person who actually planned the robbery? They're in the middle of the robbery. Where's the guy who masterminded this event? He's nowhere to be found. He's not even mentioned in any of the reports or in the trial transcript besides where Mr. Jones mentions him in his interview. So, no, it does not seem that there's sufficient evidence to be able to say they were close enough to be able to prove that. If there are no further questions, I'll move on to the firearm charge. So, the firearm charge should be dismissed for two reasons. The first reason is that, given that there is insufficient evidence to prove that an attempted robbery occurred, there is no requisite felony that would support the firearm charge, but it should be dismissed on an independent basis. There is insufficient evidence to be able to demonstrate that anything was actually done with the firearm. So, under...
Is the evidence sufficient to support the inference that he possessed it?
So, Your Honor, I did not come to argue that, but I am prepared to. It does not seem to be. The Commonwealth had to make a leap in logic, or I'm sorry, the judge had to make a leap in logic to even prove possession. No one saw Mr. Jones with the gun. No, the gun was not found on him. No statements were made about the gun. There was absolutely no mention of it. After the arrest took place, later the police received a call at the precinct. We don't know anything about that call. All we know is that later they went and they searched the rear of a church that was nearby where this had taken place, and they found a gun there. For all we know, that call that was made to the precinct was someone from the church saying, hey, there's a shotgun in the backyard. Please come and get it. It actually happens fairly commonly in Petersburg. So to say...
Counsel, what was the period of time between when the police officers came to look for the gun and the time in which the alleged robbery...
I'm not sure exactly, Your Honor. I believe that it was within a matter of hours.
That's what I assumed, but it didn't exactly
stay. It was a relatively close time frame, Your Honor. I'll stipulate. That being said, there was no evidence presented at trial that Mr. Jones had even actually gone into that property, only that Mr. Jones had been chased after he was seen in the alley, and that this was one of the places that he may have briefly gone. So they got from he may have been there briefly to he had the firearm. But we'll stipulate, let's say arguendo, that Mr. Jones actually had the firearm. That is still insufficient evidence to prove that he used, attempted to use, or displayed it in a threatening manner as required by the statute. Under Yarbrough v. Commonwealth, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that you have to be in actual possession of the firearm and use or attempt to use it. The conjunctive demonstrate, I'm sorry.
But given his statement that he was there to make sure... essentially to protect Tripp.
Yes, Your Honor.
If Tripp is in the alley, and I know this, we don't have this fact, but if Tripp is in the alley to perform the robbery and is about to perform the robbery, and I'm there to protect him, and I walk into the alley possessing the shotgun.
Yes, Your Honor.
Have I used it?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the fact that the legislature actually conceived of this possibility, and they wrote two different statutes. The first statute is 18.253.1 that says you have to use, attempt to use, or display the firearm while performing one of the requisite felonies. Under 18.2-300 subsection A, the legislature said that you have to either use or merely possess a sawed-off shotgun while committing one of the violent felonies enumerated in the statute. They clearly meant to distinguish between simply having a weapon while you committed the crime versus using the weapon in the commission of the crime. If the legislature had intended for this to be sufficient evidence under 18.253.1, they could have very simply put the word possess in the statute, but they didn't.
But here, if I'm there to hold the shotgun to protect somebody else, I mean, isn't me simply being in the alley holding the gun at least partially accomplishing my objective to assist him in it? I mean, the whole point is no one's going to mess with him because he's got two guys here holding the shotgun.
I think, Your Honor, that here we're getting a little bit ahead of what the facts demonstrate. The record is devoid of any showing, one, the trip was there, two, that the robbery took place, or three, that the gun was displayed. In the act of being the person who's sitting there holding the gun, this is displaying it in a threatening manner, as the case law clearly shows. If I stood there while the robbery was committed and I held the shotgun, I certainly meet the requirements of 18.2-53.1. But let's say that I simply had the shotgun, I had a trench coat on, it's under my trench coat, I stood there the entire time and did nothing. Would I be guilty under 18.2-300A? Yes. Would I be guilty under 18.2-53.1? No. Because the fact that they clearly distinguish between possession and display. Because the fact that the robbery never actually commenced in this case, there was no holding of the shotgun during the robbery because there was no robbery. He simply had the gun arguendo. Given the, under Boynton v. Kilgore, we're supposed to read the language of the statute in its plain meaning unless there's any ambiguity in it. There is no ambiguity in 18.2-53.1. It very clearly says use, attempted use, or display in a threatening manner, as opposed to other statutes, as in 18.2-300 subsection A, that say possession. The language here is quite clear. That being said, even if the Attorney General were able to sum up some ambiguity under 18.2-53.1, the case law says that any ambiguity, well, penal statutes are construed strictly against the Commonwealth, the ambiguity is resolved in favor of the appellant. So the language is clear. Under the clear language, there was no use, there was no attempted use, there was no display, and even if there was some ambiguity to that statute, the Attorney General to walk into, that ambiguity has to be resolved in the appellant's favor. And, Your Honor, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stollard.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Craig Stollard on behalf of Commonwealth. Your Honor, the Court's already noted some of the more interesting aspects of this case. Here we have a situation unlike your typical attempt crime. Generally, when there's an attempt crime, you have the acts of the defendant. And from those acts of the defendant alone, the Court needs to determine what the intent was, whether or not those acts also constituted an act in furtherance in order not to complete the crime, but something beyond mere preparation. Now, the case law of this court has also said that when the intent is established, only slight evidence of an act in furtherance is necessary.
Mr. Stollard, on brief, the Commonwealth doesn't address either Jordan or Hobson, and they seem to be kind of the things calling out to be addressed by the Commonwealth, so I will
do that now, Your Honor. What makes this case different from those cases is while those cases we have conduct from the defendant which constitutes something that the court at that time found to be evidence sufficient of an intent, but not enough to show an act in furtherance. This case is different in the sense that we don't need to infer from the conduct what the intent was. They stated that their intent was to commit a robbery. They were in the alley to commit a robbery. So now we look at the acts of the defendants through the lens of that intent. Once we know that their intent was to commit a robbery, now let's look at their acts. Were those acts in furtherance of that intent? They had guns. They had masks. They drove to a parking lot in Petersburg. They got out of the car, put on the masks, got the guns, and walked down an alley towards the corner of a building. Knowing their intent is to commit a robbery, that would constitute an act in furtherance.
What's the evidence that the defendant actually possessed the gun?
The fact is, the officer, after he got this phone call, which again we don't know the content of, he said he went back to where the pursuit of the defendant occurred. He said he retraced the steps of where the defendant went, and that included this little garden area behind the church. And in that garden area behind the church, he found a gun under one of the bushes in that area.
I thought when he went back, he discovered the gate and then went through the gate and was in the garden.
And I believe the testimony was he saw the defendant earlier in that area.
Near the gate, but not in the garden, right?
Well, the garden, again, this is not part of the record, but Google. The garden's not large. Regardless of whether it is or isn't, near the gate and where the gun was located is probably both true. I think once you're in that garden, you're going to be near the gate. So it's a semantics issue, and I understand the court's concern, but I think the officer's intent in going back to do this was to retrace his step and try to find out where the defendant had gone. I don't think there's a situation, as counsel stated, where he got a phone call, there's a gun in this specific place, come get it. Because he didn't just go right to one place to get the gun. I think his testimony was he retraced the steps as best he could, and during that activity, he's the one who recovered the firearm.
Mr. Stallard, was the area in any way secured by police or cordoned off?
It was not, but I will say that the initial encounter with the police occurred somewhere between 5:30 and quarter to 6 in the morning. The police returned within several hours later. So the time of day, we're looking at something maybe before 8 a.m. in the morning when the police went back. So I think the time of day would be such that the likelihood of other people milling about we greatly diminished. This wasn't like 4 or 5 in the afternoon when there might be a large number of people in the area. So the likelihood of someone else having left an item there is greatly diminished given the fact the time of day and the time span between when the initial chase occurred and when the police went back to retrace their steps. And again, I think this court and other courts have said that an act in furtherance, and if This is in Rogers. The court has said, although there is no unbending guide existed as things between preparation for a crime and acts in furtherance, generally the courts have found that preparation consists of devising or arranging the means or measures necessary for the commission of the offense, which would be, I envision people sitting around the house going, okay, what do you think? We ought to rob somebody, let's find somebody to rob, let's do that. And then it goes on to say, the direct movement towards the commission after the preparations are made is what constitutes an act of furtherance. Here we have literal and figurative acts in movement. They are literally moving towards this specific location in a car with the mask and the guns, which they've also obtained.
But is there any evidence that the person that they intend to rob is there or is expected to be there, or is that all just an inference?
I think it's an inference, but I think it's a reasonable inference. Because.
Okay. But you agree there's no evidence, the Commonwealth adduced no evidence that he resided there, he was expected to be there, that's where he did his business.
That's true. And two responses to that. First of all is, what the defendants did know is they knew the full name of the person they were attempting to rob. They knew his occupation as a drug dealer. They knew he was wanted by the police, which is a lot of information for them to know about an individual. And they went to a specific location. Well, they parked in a parking lot of an apartment complex. They went across the street to a row of houses. There was nothing behind those houses. I'm sorry, it's also not part of the record. They were at a duplex, and they're behind that where a residence is. Now, we don't know who actually lived there. But I think we can infer, as much as they knew about the victim they were trying to rob, they likely also knew where to find him. The other argument would be, even if he wasn't there, I think you can infer that whoever was in that residence was going to be robbed, that they were going to rob somebody in that residence. That's a reasonable inference from the facts of this case, given their stated intent and their acts. So whether or not that specific person was there, whoever was there was going to be robbed. And I think that's also a reasonable inference this court and the trial court can draw from the facts of this case. And with respect to the firearm, I think it's clear, given the circumstances, they've established constructive possession of the firearm. And since we have the unusual situation of you can use or attempt to use a firearm while attempting to commit a crime, creates a conceptual issue, I guess. But the idea, if you're possessing a firearm with the intent to commit a robbery, you are using it, or you intend to use it, because his intent was to commit a robbery. His intent was to help his friend who's committing a robbery. Clearly, part of that means I am going to be using this when that robbery is completed, or at least to help my friend commit the robbery. And much like any other intent crime, you need to look at the intent, and you need to look at any act in furtherance. Here, they, again, express their intent, which is to commit the robbery and to help their friend do that. And the act in furtherance, he's possessed the gun, he has it with him, along with the masks and the other people involved in this. So clearly, we've got the intent to commit that crime in addition to the intent to commit the robbery. I would suggest to this court that the evidence is sufficient, and I ask the court to affirm. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 4 minutes remaining.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll attempt to clear up a few of the points that the Attorney General raised. I'll start with our last. They say that possession of the firearm with the intent to use it is sufficient under 18.2-53.1. Well, I put it to the Attorney General, then how do you explain 18.2-300 subsection A having completely different language? Under the Attorney General's reading, most of the language there is superfluous. The language requires that you possess a firearm while actually committing one of the underlying predicate acts. So the Attorney General's reading is that as long as I have the firearm with the intent to use it, then I am in fact using it. Well, under that reading, possession of the firearm and use of the firearm are basically the same thing, and most of what the legislature wrote in 18.2-53.1 is surplusage, which is poor reading of the law, and that's doesn't meet the rules of statutory construction. We look at the plain language of the statute. The language of the statute does not say the possession of the firearm is sufficient under the statute, and under the Attorney General's reading, any time that we prove that they had a firearm and that they were on their way to commit a crime, they meet the reading of the statute. That completely defeats the entire purpose of the writing of the statute. in terms of what the Attorney General said on the, there's, whenever you have intent, that there must be a sufficient, any small act in furtherance will constitute an attempt. I completely agree that once you have a conspiracy, some small acts in furtherance can constitute an attempt. But the case law has never demonstrated that once you have a conspiracy, that all acts in furtherance will constitute an attempt. Hypothetically, say that I conspired with someone to commit an arson, and then I went out and I bought matches, but I never even found out where the place was that we had agreed to burn down. We were going to go and pick a place later. The fact that I bought matches does not get me to the fact that I attempted arson. I'm still in the planning phase. Even if you have a completed plan and then take some small acts in furtherance, that does not necessarily get you to attempt, and that's what all the case law demonstrates, including Jordan, which is still controlling, which the Attorney General still has not adequately addressed. They also have not addressed any of the arguments related to 18.2-300 regarding the firearm charge. In terms of the reasonable inference, the Attorney General says that because of the fact that the defendants were walking down an alley and they were nearby a house and they knew where the victim lived, that it's a reasonable inference that they were near the location that they intended to rob. I don't understand how that's considered a reasonable inference. Even if we arguendo, they knew exactly where it was that they were going, they were on their way there at the time that they were stopped by the police, they're in an alley. Alleys go between places, and that alley can go for a great span. We know that past that alley, from the record, there's a parking lot, and who knows what's on the other side of the parking lot or how far they intended to go. We know that they arrived at the alley, and almost immediately thereafter, they're stopped by the police. Perhaps they intended to walk a block. Perhaps they intended to walk a quarter of a mile. We have no idea, because they were stopped from the police by the police before they got to where they were going. And if the Attorney General is so sure that they were near the place that they intended to rob, then where's the victim? Where's the co-defendant who actually planned the crime? Where is any of that? They can make an inference, but that certainly does not make their inference reasonable. Finally, in terms back to the firearm, even if we say arguendo that based on the firearm being found in the backyard and that Mr. Jones was possibly back there, that does not meet the requirements of the statute. The statute specifically requires that you both have the firearm and that you attempt to use or display it in a threatening manner. And that is under Yarbrough v. Commonwealth. The Supreme Court has said you need more than mere possession, and the Attorney General did not respond to that case either. We would ask the court to reverse and dismiss the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. We'll come down and greet counsel.